Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa. This is episode 3.
Len sucked on the pipe and then took a metal tool from his pocket and tamped the tobacco. Don't sell the sheriff short. His people are busy, but he knows there's an outside chance someone was targeting Tinker or one of the other people who were close to the bull. He also knows you're concerned, so you're his best chance of having someone with investigative skills and who cares about finding the culprit. Len, I chose this profession over law enforcement for a reason. Why don't you guys leave me in peace? Len smiled. Neither of us believes that, he said. What do you mean, neither of us? You and the sheriff? Len smiled as he pointed at himself and then at me. Us, he said, as he turned to leave. He hesitated and turned back. By the way, you should change your screensaver. I have floating rectangles as my screensaver. As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I got a terrible sinking feeling and ran for my office. There, scrolling across my computer monitor, was a slideshow of huge bulls positioned in a way to feature their equipment. First was the Black Angus, followed quickly by a gigantic polled Hereford, a breed with horns as wide as Texas, slid across the screen as I got into my chair and hit the escape button. Nothing happened. I tried to enter my password, only to have it rejected as a belted Swiss bull, black with a wide white band around his middle, scrolled onto the screen. I yelled for Wendy, who's been known to embarrass me by changing my screensaver and other computer settings. A scruffy brown bull that looked like a muskox scrolled into view as I was reaching for the electrical plug. What? Wendy asked from my doorway. Turn off the bulls! Don't you think they're kind of cute? She asked as she pushed me out of the desk chair and took over the keyboard. A limousine bull with a long, pale body scrolled into view as she punched keys. Suddenly, we were at the home page of a site with the tagline, Get Your Big Bull Here. In the corner was an ad for T-shirts emblazed with the logo, Nice Bull Shirt. Are you trying to get me fired? I asked as I pointed to the door. Not really, she said, still sitting in her chair. I heard that you were playing cop again, and the bull theme seemed fitting. Her face suddenly lit up, and she spun around in the chair. Before I found the big bull site, I found this site. The screen was suddenly filled with the anatomy of a well-endowed man, shown only from navel to knees. I slammed the door and braced myself against anyone trying to enter. Wendy, get that off my computer and erase any evidence that it's ever been there. Geez, don't have a calf. Her hands flew over the keyboard and the image disappeared, revealing my usual computer desktop. Another few keystrokes took her to a screen of options, and within seconds a clock was ticking as the computer told us it was deleting history. There, she said, pushing herself up from my chair. All back to boring as usual. Why do you do this to me? I asked as I resumed the chair and clicked on the icon for accessing our in-house email program. I don't know. I suppose it's because you're so easy to embarrass. Or it might be because you're such a computer novice that you can't stop me from doing whatever I want. I put a password on my screensaver to keep people out, I protested. Yeah, right, like Jenny wouldn't come to mind as your first password choice. You should at least make it challenging for me. Wendy, I don't want to challenge you. I want you to stay off my computer. My desk is right outside the director's office. How am I supposed to access my personal email if I don't use your computer? Torture someone else for a while, or use the computer in the library like the residents and housekeeping people do. Wendy developed a broad, mischievous smile. What fun would that be? She asked as she disappeared out the door. I was deep in my email when a knock on my door brought me out of computer stupor. Nancy, the director, was standing there. I raced through possible scenarios of screw-ups, but couldn't come up with anything except that someone had walked into my office and seen the scrolling bowls. I had Wendy change my screensaver back to the floating rectangles, I offered half as apology. That's nice. Did she do that before the people started lining up for their ride to the doctor? I pulled the van keys out of my desk drawer and hopped out of my chair. I'm on it, I said, waiting for her to step aside so I could run to the door and my waiting patients. Based on what I've heard, you should probably lock your computer so the bulls don't return, she said as I put the keys in my pocket. She was smiling, so I figured she'd been in on the joke with Wendy, or at least knew it wasn't my choice of screensaver. As I stood, I entered a few keystrokes to lock the computer and return it to the usual screensaver. When I turned, Nancy was still standing in the door. I heard that the sheriff asked you to apply to be a deputy. Does that mean that you're leaving? No, I like it here. Exactly what happened at the fair yesterday? She asked. A bull went nuts when Tinker was walking past, and he got injured. Does the sheriff think a crime is involved? We talked to a girl who saw the bull get hit with a rubber band that appears to be the cause of his episode. It hardly seems likely that a rubber band would cause a bull to rampage, Nancy observed. It was a really strong rubber band, and it hit him in a painful spot. Like the eye? Further back. The witness said that he was hit in his equipment. I could feel the red creeping up my neck. Hit his equipment? Nancy asked. Testicles, I replied, feeling the red reach my temples. Somehow explaining this to Nancy was like having the sex talk with my mother. Ouch! Hence the bull parade on the computer? I'd better run so no one misses an appointment, I said as I pushed past her. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 5. Sitting in the clinic waiting room afforded me plenty of time to mull over the events in the cattle barn. I could now visualize the crowd of people shuffling ahead of me and Tinker sliding along the edge of the cattle stalls. I was so focused on Tinker and Tubby that I had no recollection of any of the other faces. It was just a sea of bodies surging ahead of me. I'd forgotten, but I now remembered hearing the bull roar, probably in pain, a fraction of a second before I saw Tinker crushed by the gate. People scattered as the bull bucked. Many people escaped down the aisle as the bull's owner struggled to gain control. I was moving toward Tinker, fighting the flow of people as they fled the scene of the raging bull. The bull settled down, and the young handler moved him away from the open gate where Tinker lay on the ground. After the EMT took over, I ran back to Tubby to make sure he was safe, and then the deputies arrived. There was nothing useful in my memory. The mammogram went quickly, but Bessie again grumbled about the cost of having only one breast examined while being charged for two. B. Robbins, who was a little less lucid than some of our residents, was quite pleased by her doctor visit. She had a few skin abnormalities removed for biopsy, but remembered nothing but the delightful doctor and the glass of orange juice they'd given her. No pain and no complaints. I left the van's air conditioner running when I went into the hospital to retrieve Hulda Packer from her MRI, or MRE, depending on who you believed. Hulda was sitting in the lobby when I arrived. She pushed herself out of the chair and met me halfway across the lobby. It's about time, Hulda said as she passed me. I was done with the doctor hours ago. I helped Hulda up the three steps into the van and then closed the doors. In the short trip from the air-conditioned van to the air-conditioned lobby and back again, I'd developed sweat stains on my dark blue shirt. I noticed that Bessie wasn't as tall as she'd been earlier in the morning. The humidity was taking its toll on her new perm. As the van pulled onto the street, Hulda stepped across the aisle and slid into the seat behind me and said, "You know that Tinker Oldham wasn't much of a farmer." "Was his farm near Two Harbors?" No, Holder replied. He farmed down in the swamp country by Mottawa. He's here because his kids live north of Duluth. You said he wasn't much of a farmer. What do you mean? He didn't really farm as much as he raised animals. I think he bought a lot of old horses and mules and had a riding farm. He had the most pathetic bunch of sway-backed old nags that I'd ever seen, and he never took care of the fences. Cars hit two of his mules, and the neighbors shot a couple horses when they repeatedly raided their gardens. I assumed the poor things were just trying to find food because he didn't have enough pasture for the number of animals he had, and he never put up enough hay to feed them through the winter. It sounds like the Humane Society or someone would be after him. Not in the old days. People minded their own business, and we stayed out of the neighbors' business. People beat their wives, and others molested children. Tinker neglected his horses. Sometimes a person might meet up with vigilante justice, and sometimes an angry father or jealous husband would exact retribution. It's just the way things were. Did Tinker ever get retribution? He went broke, so I guess that's one form of retribution. He sold all his horses to a glue factory or something and took a job in Duluth at the horseshoe factory. Then the horseshoe factory went under and he went to work in the paper mill. Every time he started to get ahead, bad luck hit him again. In the end, all he had left was a few tools, so he started his fix-it business to supplement the few dollars he got in pension. His wife and kids stuck with him? I asked. Sure, there weren't many options in those days. One of his boys joined the army when he turned 17 and was killed in Vietnam. His daughter got pregnant and married a hothead who beat her regularly until she shot him. I think she's out of prison now. The youngest son decided to be a farmer and bought a place out in Alden Township. He raises a few cattle and he does taxidermy on the side. He was the brightest of the bunch, and he seems to be doing okay. What happened to Tinker's wife? She had a bout of breast cancer when he was between jobs and didn't have insurance. By the time she went to the doctor, it was too late to treat it. They made her comfortable, and she died after a couple of months. I suppose some people looked on that as divine justice. I thought it was a tragic end to a life filled with bad choices, starting with her decision to marry Tinker. How do you know about all this? I asked. Hulda shrugged. Some I heard from my sister in Mottawa. The rest I heard from the other folks after his move to Whistling Pines. I measured her lucidity and wondered how much I should discount her comments based on her jumbled memories. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 6. I pulled under the Whistling Pines portico, helped the ladies down the steps, and guided them through the front door. As I parked the van, I ran Hulda's comments through my mind. Was it possible that someone with a grudge about the treatment of Tinker's horses seized an opportunity to teach him a lesson? What were the odds that someone like that would have a supply of rubber bands in hand, would be able to take several practice shots without drawing notice, and would have the perfect angle on Cosmo to put him into a rage? Megan had looked at a stall across the aisle when I asked who might have shot the errant binder. Every angle I looked at made me more convinced that a prankster had taken his shot, and Tinker happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Jenny met me in the lobby and nodded toward the large aviary on the west wall of the atrium. With the lovebirds cooing in the background, Jenny said, "Tinker is out of the coma and talking to the nurses." She was visibly relieved. "Is his prognosis for recovery good?" "He's not a kid, so the healing process won't go quickly, but at least he's out of the woods for now. He has several broken ribs, so it pains him to take a deep breath, which of course counterbalances the doctor's wishes to have him breathe deeply and cough so he doesn't get pneumonia." "Is pneumonia of concern? Can't they treat him with antibiotics?" They're filling him with antibiotics, but if he can't clear his lungs... Jenny paused to collect herself. When our seniors fall down and break a hip, it's not the broken hip that kills them, it's the pneumonia that follows. I thought you had good news. That was good news. It's just that we have to temper it with a little reality. So, are we taking a deep breath and hoping for the best? Does that mean we can take the weekend off and do something fun? Jenny smiled and I melted. She could have asked me to drive to San Diego and I would have been gassing up the car. Remember, Jeremy asked you to take him to the county fair tomorrow, she said. My less than enthusiastic expression must have leaked through my happy facade because she quickly added, I know you've already been there, but I was hoping it could be a bonding experience. I put on my best smile and took her hand in mine. I'm sorry, it slipped my mind in all the commotion. Jenny hugged me and whispered, Thanks for being a good sport. Jeremy's going to an overnight birthday party tomorrow after the fair, and my parents want us to have dinner with them. I was first excited that Jeremy was engaged for the night, hoping that would free Jenny for our own sleepover, then deflated when I heard about the dinner plans. Jenny's parents were stalwart members of the community who intimidated me with their starched shirt attitude and model home decor that looked like no one ever sat on the couches. As usual, Wendy was walking by at the most inopportune time and shook her head. Why don't you two get a room? Jenny winked at her and said, We will, as she released her hug and walked away. I walked back to my office and surprised Nancy, who was writing me a note. Peter, Nancy said, picking up the note and handing it to me. I had a call from John Carr, the Two Harbors City Band Director. They have a problem. What's the problem? Everyone in Two Harbors knew John Carr. He'd been the director of the Two Harbors City Band since anyone could remember. The band is the longest-standing city band in Minnesota, with roughly 50 dedicated people ranging from high school musicians to octogenarians. They were most noted for their Thursday evening concerts in the Thomas Owens Park band shell during the summer, which Jenny and I often attended. John broke his heel, Nancy explained. The band is scheduled to perform at the county fair on Saturday night, and he'd like you to fill in as director. I was dumbfounded, which Nancy mistook for reluctance. Peter, this would generate a lot of goodwill for Whistling Pines. I'd like you to do this. I'm honored to be asked, but Saturday is tomorrow. I'm not sure I'm qualified, and there's no time to prepare. You'll do very well, she said, as she handed me the phone number. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 7. I dialed the number. A male voice answered, Hello, this is John. Hi, this is Peter from Whistling Pines. I had a message to call you. Peter, how good of you to call. I'm sure Nancy already told you about my dilemma. Is there any chance that you can direct the city band tomorrow night? Mr. Carr, I'm really honored to be asked, but I'm not sure I'm qualified. He laughed. I saw you sit in with the gin fizzes at Hugo's bar last spring. You have a great voice, and you were the best musician on the stage. He asked, How many instruments can you play? I'm pretty good on the piano and guitar. I've dabbled with the alto sax, flute, and clarinet, but I wouldn't be comfortable playing any of the woodwinds in public. Carr laughed and said, I have a lot of good musicians, but you'll be among the most versatile musicians there. You'll do fine. He paused and added, Besides, you can't be too good, or the band won't want me back again. I let out a deep sigh and looked at the calendar. It's already Friday, and I've never seen the music. Is there a practice tonight? Most of the band is attending the fair today, so we didn't plan for another practice before the show. I'll have Brian Johnson, one of the tuba players, drop off the music this afternoon so you can look at it. He may be a little pouty because he's the backup director, but since he's one of only two tuba players, he'll have to deal with it. Oh, great, I thought. I'll have an unhappy tuba player on top of having no credibility with the band. Peter, you've heard the tuba player jokes? John asked, interrupting my thought. I'm afraid not. Are there a lot of tuba jokes? For some reason, tuba and trombone players seem to be a little different, John said. Anyway, there are two tuba players in a car. Who's driving? I don't know. The cop. I had a vision of two men in the back of a police car with their tubas and let out a groan. The band plays at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and most of the musicians will be there half an hour early. Have fun. They're a good bunch, and you'll do well. I'll try. I went to the restroom, and when I returned to my office, I found Wendy sitting at my desk staring at the computer. At first, I was irritated that she'd taken over my computer again, and then I looked at the computer screen and froze. She turned and looked at me and then turned back to the computer without comment. Wendy, why are there naked women on my computer? Your computer is locked up and they won't go away, she said. I can see that, I said, but why did they show up there at all? When I left, the screensaver was flashing swirling rectangles against a black background that should have been protected by my password. Wendy gave me a disgusted look and said, that terribly secure new password, Angus? That's not obvious, I protested. She waved off my protest. I was curious, she replied. You were curious about naked women? I had another crummy date with a scumbag I met at one of the band gigs, she said, her fingers now flying over the keyboard with no apparent effect on the locked screen. And what has a scumbag date got to do with naked women on my computer? I decided that maybe I had a problem with guys. At first I thought that maybe I was being too picky and that I needed to lower my standards. Then, after the scumbag, I decided that I couldn't let my standards get that low. I figured that maybe I needed to enter a convent, but that seemed a little too drastic. So then I decided that maybe I should try being a lesbian. I was speechless. I'd worked with Wendy for several years and had seen her performing with the Gin Fizzes. She flirted shamelessly with anything male and seemed hypersexual, if anything. She'd flirted with me when I'd started at Whistling Pines, but quickly decided that I was too boring to be of interest. Her tastes seemed to run toward guys with a bad boy image. I don't think that people make a decision to change their sexual orientation, I said. I think they discover that they're attracted to either men or women, and that's just the way they're wired. She stopped keyboarding to stare at the naked forms on the computer screen and then commented, "You're probably right. These bimbos just aren't lighting my fire like a cute guy with a manly mustache." She spun in the chair and walked to the door. I sat at the keyboard and tried a number of keystrokes to make the naked ladies disappear. Nothing I keyed had any effect. I moved the mouse and noticed that the cursor was locked in one spot near the behind of a full-figured girl chasing a volleyball. "Don't bother," Wendy said as she left. "It's locked up. You'll have to do a hard shutdown and hope that the screen is gone when the computer restarts." With that, she was gone from the scene of her crime. I was holding the power switch, waiting for the 5-second delay before the computer started a hard shutdown, when I heard someone entering my office. I prayed it wasn't Nancy, who would probably fire me on the spot if she caught me with porn on my computer screen. "Peter, could you..." The question froze a second before the computer screen went blank. "What are you looking at?" Jenny asked. "Wendy was looking at nude women to see if she's a lesbian," I quickly explained. "What? No, really," I said as the computer screen went black. Wendy had another bad date and decided that maybe she was really into women and that was why she was having so many problems dating guys. So her solution was to pull up images of nude women on your computer? "Scout's honor," I said, holding up my right hand in the 3-fingered Boy Scout oath. "You can ask her." Jenny wasn't pleased, but left, having forgotten whatever it was that had brought her to my doorway, and before I could tell her about my gig as a substitute city band director. To my great relief, the computer prompted me for my password and opened to my usual desktop. I put it into sleep mode and briefly wondered if I could find the key to lock my office. I quickly dismissed the idea. Even if I could find a key buried somewhere in a desk drawer, Wendy has a master key that can open any of the few locked doors in the whole of Whispering Pines. I picked up the September activities schedule and went to the little cluster of offices near the entrance to run copies. Nancy was on the phone, so I started the copies and stuck my head in the nursing office where Jenny was studying a medical file in a red three-ring binder. You'll never guess who's filling in as the guest director for the Two Harbors City Band tomorrow night, I said. She looked up, and I could see how tired she was. Are they playing at the band shell? They're playing at the fairgrounds, and John Carr has a broken heel. The idea of directing the band was starting to grow on me. I don't think we have time to stay around to hear the concert, she said. We're taking Jeremy to the fair, and then we're having dinner with my parents. Before I could respond, Wendy pushed past me and sat in the extra chair. It's so unfair that they'd ask Peter to be the fill-in director and not me. What? Jenny asked. John Carr asked Peter to be the fill-in director for the city band tomorrow night. Peter's not even from Two Harbors. How can he be the director of the city band? How do you know that? I asked. I only talked to him 20 minutes ago. Wendy gave me a sly grin, but didn't answer. She set a crossword puzzle on the desk and plucked a pen from a cup emblazoned with the Paxil logo. That's great, Peter, Jenny replied with an edge to her voice. I'll have to call my mother and tell her that we'll have to reschedule our dinner with them. My heart deflated like someone stepping on a ketchup package. Dang it, my reply lacked sincerity. You have to direct the band, Wendy said. It's a big honor. I'm sure your mother will understand, I said, trying to recover some dignity. They love going with us to the summer concerts. You should invite them to the fair concert, and we can go out to eat afterward. Why don't you call your mother, too, Jenny suggested. I'm sure that she'd come up from Duluth to watch her son's directing debut. The slight rebound that I'd got from suggesting that Jenny's parents come to the band concert was quickly offset by the thought of my mother driving from Duluth to watch the Two Harbors City Band at the county fair. Mother and I have a good relationship as long as we limit our contact to a Sunday evening call that recaps her week, after which I say, I love you, before hanging up. My mother is a very artistic person who lives her life through her charitable activities. She serves meals at the teen rehab facility 3 days a week. She is a docent at the Duluth Railroad Museum. She is a volunteer reader at the library Children's Hour, and she personally has adopted 2 miles of Highway 210 near Carleton, where she rallies her friends as she leads the caravan of helpers to pick up trash 3 times a year.
The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.